Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people, certainly in the fourth estate, as they call the media, who understand this war better and who have been doing more intrepid investigative reporting in support of America in its fight than our first guest. He is Richard Pollack. You have been seeing a lot of him lately and hearing from him, notably in connection with one of his most recent investigative coups, namely exposing the full import, well, maybe not the full import, but the significant new element of the scandal of Hillary Clinton's improper, indeed malfeasant use of personal servers for her official emails as Secretary of State. It is a great pleasure to say that the work that Richard Pollack is doing at the Daily Caller is getting front page news coverage and even tweets from the President of the United States, and I'm so glad to have him back to talk with us a little bit about his work. Richard, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you.
So the quick, short course on what you have uncovered with respect to Hillary's exposing of not only classified information, but even just her sensitive official and personal correspondence and its implications.
Well, about a month ago, Congressman Louie Gohmert, who's a Republican of Texas and actually a former prosecutor and judge, raised the issue that a foreign entity had systematically breached Hillary Clinton's server. This is the server that was in her home. It was a private server in which she conducted official diplomatic business. We've now identified the country and the foreign entity. The country is not Russia, by the way, as Congressman Gohmert mentioned as well. It is the People's Republic of China. They ran an aggressive intelligence operation over the entire 4 years that Secretary Clinton was at the State Department, and they did it using a Chinese state-owned company based in Northern Virginia. And this company, on a 24/7 basis, was able to penetrate her email server and be able to copy all of her incoming and outgoing emails. So these are emails about diplomatic strategy, arms control, negotiations, sensitive negotiations with both allies and hostile figures, probably the early discussions about strategy over the Iranian nuclear deal. Every single item that Secretary Clinton had on her desk, they were all delivered to the Chinese Republic. And the way that they did it is they placed a code in her, remotely, I might add. They placed a code and embedded it into the server. And every time an email came in or went out, there was a courtesy copy that was reproduced and sent to this company in Northern Virginia. And they, in turn, sent it to China. And this is an extraordinary breach of national security proportions. Probably we've never seen a breach of this nature in the history of the modern presidency.
This is a stunning revelation, Richard Pollack. And the fact is that knowledge of what had happened here was in the hands of government officials before you broke your story. Is that correct? And what was done with this information heretofore?
So this is a story behind the story, and it's fascinating. The Inspector General for the entire intelligence community was able to identify in early 2015, remember, this is more than a year before the election, that there was an anomaly in her headers and footers of her emails, and they were able to trace it back to this embedded code that was sending these copies to China. They then took the information and they went directly to the FBI. They went to its top counterterrorism director, and his name is Peter Strzok. And they met with Strzok on multiple occasions, provided their evidence, and according to information I have received, he was stone-faced. He was not convinced that there was a problem. He was gave them a hard look and basically walked away from this issue. And the Congressman Gohmert mentioned the same thing when he actually confronted Strzok in that congressional hearing at the House Judiciary Committee. He said, "Do you remember this, these briefings?" And he said, "No, I don't." Now, just let's step back for one quick second and ask ourselves, you're the top counterintelligence official, and you're told the People's Republic of China has systematically 24/7 broken into Hillary Clinton's server over a four-year period. I think the first thing you do is you start mobilizing the forces of the national security community. What's the damage assessment? What can we do to prevent it or minimize it? Mobilizing both the National Security Agency, the CIA, all of our intelligence assets, and beginning to try to figure out how much was lost, what damage was done. Who is responsible?
And he claims that he doesn't even remember having the conversation, as opposed to having taken any of those steps. And again, Peter Strzok was at the time the top counterintelligence official in the FBI. So this would have been squarely in his portfolio. Only it seems, as we have seen again and again and again in various other capacities, he was working for Hillary Clinton, protecting her and shutting down investigations or otherwise protecting her from criminal prosecution. It's a scandal of just epic proportions. Let me talk to you about one other quickly, which the Daily Caller News Foundation investigative unit has been doing extraordinary work on, and I want to thank you, Richard Pollack, as well as your colleague Luke Rosiak for it. And that is the House IT scandal, as it's come to be called. It seems as though there's a similar set of practices happening there, too, a pattern, if you will, of looking the other way, taking no appropriate actions to criminally prosecute or otherwise stem the damage that might be done by apparently another intelligence operation, this one run by Pakistan against Democratic members of Congress. Can you comment on that?
Sure. Well, Luke is an exceptional reporter here in town. I'm really delighted that he's in our unit. Look, once again, Democrats are just turning over a treasure trove of intelligence information to either hostile forces, depends how you want to define Pakistan. Once again, we see the mainstream media, first of all, they ignored the story for 6 months to a year. Then they denied the story, and then they decided to go and attack and say this story is a bunch of BS. And I think that this is their MO. Rather than following the story and trying to get to the story's end and following the trail, they have political loyalties that trump that, and that's really where they're at. That they do these they consider these to be inconvenient stories out there that really, I think, expose the lax attitude that Democrats in general have had toward national security issues.
Richard Pollack, there's so much more to talk about here. I cannot thank you enough, Richard, for your leadership and your intrepid reporting. Next up, Ben Weingarten of The Federalist joins us right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Benjamin Weingarten, one of the brightest, relatively young men I've had the privilege of getting to know and work with in this battle space of the war for the free world, is in the House virtually, I'm pleased to say. Ben is a 2015 Publius Fellow of the Claremont Institute, a very high commendation, but he is also the host of the Big Ideas podcast, a senior fellow of the London Center for Public Policy, and a senior contributor to The Federalist, at which he has been writing in recent days a lot about yet another of the scandals that should be drawing attention, at the very minimum, scrutiny preferably, and punishments, but because it involves Democratic members of Congress or others engaged in mishandling of classified information, it seems as though a separate set of rules apply. We've been talking about that subject with Richard Pollack. We're now going to have Ben Weingarten's ideas on it. Ben, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Frank, thanks for that kind introduction, and it's always a pleasure.
Well, listen, it's deserved, especially as I read through some of the things that you've been writing most recently about Dianne Feinstein. Senator Feinstein, of course, was the past chairman and is now the ranking member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, an extremely sensitive position in the United States Congress, needless to say. And yet we learn she had a Chinese communist spy on her staff, someone who would drive her when she was in Northern California, presumably had access not only to a lot of her private conversations while in the car, but also who knows what all else. Tell us about the story there, Ben.
Yeah, so this alleged spy, his name is Russell Lowe, as uncovered by the Daily Caller, worked for Dianne Feinstein for 20 years. And allegedly, 5 years ago, Feinstein was contacted by the FBI and made aware of the fact that this individual, Mr. Lowe, had been approached by the Chinese Ministry of State Security, which is effectively their KGB or FSB, and was used to collect intelligence on Senator Feinstein, who, as you noted, is a very high-ranking senior senator. At the time, was chair of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, which deals, of course, with the most sensitive and highly classified information. And Mr. Lowe was effectively, quietly, quickly let go. And this was reported in almost an aside, essentially, in a piece on, more broadly, China's and Russia's efforts to infiltrate Silicon Valley, which of course includes politicians out there like Senator Feinstein. And what I did was ask a simple question. If the Chinese embedded this spy within Dianne Feinstein's office, shouldn't we look a little bit more at Feinstein's links, associations, ties to the Chinese, just like we're doing right now with Donald Trump and the Russians? And what I found was a staggering story of 40 years of close ties at the highest levels of the Chinese Communist Party between Senator Feinstein and the Chinese officials, including Jiang Zemin, who was effectively the Xi Jinping of his day. Feinstein taking uniformly pro-Chinese positions in terms of incorporating them into the global trade infrastructure, which has enabled their economic rise. Also dovishness with respect to China on foreign policy, and absolving them of all their sins with respect to grave human rights abuses, whitewashing it and trying to draw moral equivalence with the U.S. And then lastly, and most importantly, the fact that Senator Feinstein's family has enriched itself alongside China's economic growth, which she supported through direct investments and indirect investments tied to Chinese growth by way of her husband, billionaire investor Richard Blum.
Do you have any sense, just on that last point, Ben Weingarten, as to the enormity of that enriching?
Well, what we can glean from public records is that he's raised several hundred million dollars worth of investments associated with Asia generally and China and Chinese-related companies specifically. So at the very, very least, he would have collected millions of dollars in fees from managing these funds invested in China. But then, of course, there were direct investments as well. One of the things that I found in doing my research was that he invested in a financial institution in China, which basically represented the first outside, call it plurality, investment in a Chinese financial institution. Now, how was his investor group able to get access to that investment? And that's really the question that you have to ask with respect to his investments and his company's investments in China from the start. He was investing heavily during the 90s, when it's not as if China was completely open to foreign investors from the U.S. It turns out that Blum was going on trips with Dianne Feinstein dating back to the early 90s, and perhaps even before then, and had contact with Chinese officials even in the 80s when Dianne Feinstein was mayor of San Francisco, developing a sister city relationship with Shanghai. It's very clear that he would not have been in these sorts of positions were it not for who his wife was and the contacts made during his career.
Connections, as they say in China, I think. So going back to the repercussions of all this, Ben Weingarten, as best we can tell, the Chinese intelligence services would have been gaining access to information from Dianne Feinstein, if not actually classified information, certainly sensitive information. You've raised the specter that blackmail could have been one of the applications of that information. What was the upshot of all of this? You say that this spy was let go quietly by Dianne Feinstein. Were charges pressed either by her or by the United States government, knowing that they were dealing with a foreign espionage agent?
Amazingly, to the best of our knowledge, it does not appear that any charges were filed. And the way his sort of intelligence gathering effort was cast was that he had provided political intelligence. So, of course, we have no idea of what he elected while he was driving around Senator Feinstein for years and serving as an office director out in California and also serving as her liaison to the Asian community, including liaising with Chinese officials, of course. It's unimaginable, potentially, the security breach that occurred here. We don't know any of the specifics, and that's one of the reasons why I've asked these questions in articles. Merely one representative in Congress has sent a letter to Christopher Wray, FBI director, asking for further detail on what happened. But amazingly, this individual, Mr. Lowe, seems to now be fronting for a group which focuses on the concept of comfort women, which has been a Chinese propaganda focus for many years, basically to cast the Japanese in a very negative light and thereby obfuscate from China's own human rights abuses, which continue to this day.
Right. You know, this reminds me of another instance of congressional Democrats seemingly being penetrated, possibly compromised, certainly their private and official correspondence being exposed to compromise by foreign nationals. And I'm talking, as I did a moment ago with Richard Pollack, about the House IT scandal. And then, of course, there's the story that Richard Pollack has broken about Hillary Clinton's emails being in real time delivered to the Chinese government and its intelligence services. And there does seem to be an unmistakable pattern here. Nobody is really held accountable. Imran Nawaz of the House IT scandal got not even a slap on the wrist. He got a suspended slap on the wrist. Hillary Clinton, of course, is still walking around, still, as best I can tell, has access to state secrets. And this raises a question. Ben Weingarten, as a serious student of these matters, doesn't there have to be some accountability? How could it be that this is entirely ignored, it seems, on the Democratic side of the ledger, and yet this unbelievable expenditure of time and government resources and national political energy is expended on monitoring something that seems at best a nothing burger, and at worst, as the president says, a witch hunt if it happens to involve a Republican like him.
Amazingly, the only person who is facing accountability for no wrongdoing, and that is the president. I mean, compare and contrast the president's situation with that of Feinstein, for example. The president, to our knowledge, only had spies in his campaign who were embedded by the U.S. government against him. Feinstein actually had what appears to be a Chinese spy on her payroll. And by the way, this was during President Trump's campaign, spies being embedded in his staff. This was while Feinstein was actually serving as the chair of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Senator Feinstein also has a long career of favorable policy towards the Chinese, which have aided them immensely. I mean, you can make an argument that she's responsible for hundreds of billions of dollars in wealth creation in China by dint of her lobbying on behalf of that government at a very senior level.
from which she may have profited personally as well, according to what you've told us about her husband, at the very least.
At the very least, appearance of a conflict of interest, and very likely a conflict of interest, a big-time conflict of interest. And compare and contrast that with the president, whose policies towards Russia have actually been very hostile from the Russian perspective. I mean, we're arming all the people who are in what Russia would like to be its near abroad. We've taken a very hostile measures towards them in any number of realms on the national security and foreign policy side. What I would say, though, is that this isn't actually a partisan issue, although generally it tends to be Republicans and conservatives who are in the crosshairs and those on the left who get to skate. What this is the bureaucratic class, the administrative state, versus everyone else and anyone who would dare challenge it. And that transcends parties, and I think that is the fundamental issue here, which is that anyone who actually poses a real challenge to the status quo, thereby challenging the power of those of the political few at the top of these institutions, must be destroyed. And that crosses party lines, and unfortunately, that establishment is very broad when it comes to party identification.
Yeah. Well, however one cuts it, this is a set of scandals of the first order. And Ben Weingarten, we appreciate tremendously the writing and the podcasting that you are doing on these subjects. Hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Michel Garfinkel from France. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. A good friend from across the pond is in the house virtually. His name is Michel Garfinkel. He is an extraordinarily thoughtful, insightful, highly respected, and quite influential expert on a host of matters inside his native France. He is the founder and president of the Jean-Jacques Rousseau Institute, which is a conservative think tank there. He is these days the Shulman Ginsberg Fellow at the Middle East Forum and the editor-in-chief of Valeurs Actuelles, which is a conservative news weekly. He's most highly regarded, as far as I'm concerned, for his astute analyses of what is happening inside France with respect to the rising tide of what I think of as Sharia supremacism. Michel Garfinkel, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
It's so nice to be with you.
I wanted to particularly pick your brains because I've seen in the past day or two a very interesting piece by a man I think you know, Yves Mamou, who has written for the Gatestone Institute an essay entitled Macron's Partition of France. And it describes in considerable detail a kind of series of, well, one might call them salami slices that have been taken increasingly to accommodate the Sharia supremacists who are in France in quite large numbers now. And most especially, it seems, sort of the leading edge of their jihadist enterprise, the Muslim Brotherhood. Talk a little bit about the facts on the ground as you see them, both sort of the demographic and the political elements thereof.
Okay, so I think it would be safe to say that 25% of the youth of France, people under the age of 20, are Muslim nowadays. And what is even more interesting in this respect is that whereas only 40% of those young French boys and girls who describe themselves as Christian say that religion is important to them, 80% of those who describe themselves as Muslims say that religion is important to them. So clearly, the Islamic religion now is an enormous fact inside, within French society at large. And Islam is a much more vital and, should I say, aggressive or assertive religion than the other religions of France, and especially Roman Catholicism, which used to be until very recently the dominant religion of the country.
Now, let me just ask you on this point, because the question of whether they're Muslim or they're not Muslim, whether they're devout Muslims or they're not devout Muslims, is very much an integral piece of the question of Sharia and the sort of supremacism that it requires of its adherents. Not all Muslims in the United States, I think, and perhaps in France as well, embrace Sharia or seek to live under it or to impose it on everybody else. Do you have a sense, Michel Garfinkel, when you look at that statistic of 80% of the quarter of the youth of France who are Muslim embrace that Sharia doctrine, the political, military, legal sort of ideology, if you will, of Islam?
Well, I wouldn't say that every Muslim in France is a strict supporter of Sharia, but we have evidence that whereas 20 years ago, only 20 to 30% of the French Muslims did fast throughout the month of Ramadan, today the rate is 70%. We know that whereas the Islamic garb used to be a rarity about 20 years ago when actually a law was passed in France limiting the public display of the Islamic garb.
For women in particular, right?
For women, of course. Sometimes for men as well. Today, it's getting more and more widespread. So very clearly, we have a tendency for Muslims to be more observant. And each religion has its own idiosyncrasies. And Islam doesn't work as a religion if you subtract from it its political and, in a way, military aspect. Islam is the politics of God. You know, this is Islam. For Christians, Christianity is Christ. For Islam, Islam is the politics of God. Period.
Yeah. Well, especially for those who embrace this this Sharia doctrine, that's for sure. So bring us back, Michel Garfinkel, if you would, to this essay in Gatestone by Yves Mamou, in which he talks about the sort of accommodations, the serial accommodations to what I think you've described as kind of the facts on the ground that particularly President Emmanuel Macron of France has now found himself having to contend with?
Well, Yves Mamou, who is an excellent and outstanding journalist, he was for many years with Le Monde, which is one of the flagships of the French press, maybe a liberal newspaper, but still a very serious paper. Well, Mamou says essentially that Macron is envisioning, in fact, modifying the law of separation of church and state in France, finding ways to organize a kind of mutual support between the state and religion, and especially the Muslim religion. There is nothing new about it. Everybody knows that the law of separation of church and state, as it exists in France, and it's very different from separation, church-state separation in the United States. It's vastly different. So as it used to work in France, it was based on the assumption that the state would not interfere with religions and would not fund any religious institution. Now, for many years, for almost one century, at least since World War II, this was totally forgotten. There were many ways by which the government, in fact, was subsidizing a lot of religious institutions, a lot of churches or synagogues, and later on mosques have been built with public money and defined as cultural centers.
So, Michel, we're going to run out of time before we run out of topics here, but I just want to cut to the chase. What has been happening, as I understand it, has been a series of accommodations, including, as Mamou puts it, an effort to essentially stand up the leading edge, as I say, of this Sharia supremacist enterprise as part of the presidential council of the city, which will have discretion over the expenditure of funds inside the cities of France, which are, among other places, the locus of much of the migration that has taken place over the past few decades, including most recently in the past few years. Is that right? Is that of concern that perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars will be essentially put at the disposal of people who espouse the division of France, who espouse, you know, the submission of really the whole place to Sharia?
What Mamou writes in his article is that the president, in fact, discussed the matter not just with Muslim leaders, but with the leaders of the other religions in France, including the Catholic Church. And in fact, every organized religion in France is interested in the president's proposals, because maybe some power and money will be transferred to Muslim institutions, which may be dominated by the Muslim Brothers or other Muslim Brotherhoods. But on the other hand, that will be also an opportunity for the rest of the French religion, and especially the Christian religions, to the various Christian churches, to have way more funding and influence as it is the case now. So we may not go towards a situation of partition between the French state and the Muslim religion. We may come to a situation where France at large will resemble Lebanon, where the country is divided along religious lines. And many non-Muslims, many Christians, for instance, in France, may at the present stage think and say that this is an opportunity that may help Christianity to be revived in this country.
This is such an important topic, and I'm so sorry that we are hard out of time at the moment to discuss it further with you, Michel Garfinkel, but I want to come back to it with you in the very near future if we can, because I'm persuaded that what we're seeing play out in France and in so many other countries in Europe is sadly what these Sharia supremacists have in mind for the rest of us. The demographic details and so on are obviously somewhat different, but the ultimate agenda is unmistakable, and the accommodations that we've been talking about that France has been making to this appetite for submission on the part of these jihadis cannot be underestimated in terms of its strategic implications for both sides of the pond. Thank you for your courage and clarity in addressing these issues at Valeurs Actuelles and, of course, at the Jean-Jacques Rousseau Institute. Michel Garfinkel, I'll come back to us again very soon, if you will. Next up, Diana West joins us. We'll be visiting with her about the Islamic Saudi Academy, Terror High, as it's known, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. It is always a pleasure to say we're joined by Diana West, one of our regular features here at Secure Freedom Radio, a longtime syndicated columnist, a best-selling author, a blogger par excellence, and a good friend of this program. Diana is, of course, the author of two best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. She also can be found at the Daily Caller from time to time, and certainly at her site, DianaWest.net. We're always glad to find her here. Diana, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you. Wonderful to be with you.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about a couple of things just that have come across my transom in the past 24 hours, Diana, that you, with your understanding of both the history of so many of these dramas and the importance of what we have seen in the past to not only the present, but to our future. One of which was a revelation that the woman who was running against David Bratt, a congressman from the 7th District of Northern Virginia, he is, I think, a remarkable member of Congress, but his rival is a woman by the name of Abigail Spanberger. And I understand that she was previously employed by something called the Islamic Saudi Academy, and that she's anxious, it appears, for voters not to know about that past connection, because apparently she is threatening a lawsuit against people who have brought some of this information to light as a result of a Freedom of Information Act with the Postal Service, I believe, somehow they're involved in all of this. Diana, can you refresh our memory about the Islamic Saudi Academy? It was a controversial place a few years back, and I'd like to think it may have some bearing on this person's perspective and future conduct, as well as her past associations. Could you shed light on that?
Yes, absolutely. But I mean, just the introduction to the story would seem to be enough for voters to make up their minds, given that candidates should not be trying to close doors, threatening lawsuits, having to do with their past employment. And so that becomes such a red flag. And when we actually go back and look at what the Saudi Islamic Academy was and was known for going back, say, 10, 12 years, we find that even the Associated Press called the place Terror High. And we had a number of U.S. senators actually interested in investigating it, in closing it. You even had Senator Schumer talking about this.
My word.
I know. This was another era, because he was actually concerned about anti-Americanism. Of course, this goes way back to 2005. So we are looking at something that is a story that should develop. And you know, kudos to the groups that are trying to shed light on this documentation of this woman's career. I can't speak to it. We don't know what it is yet. But this is a tremendous interest to the voters of Virginia. And we're seeing this play out all over the country with these stealth jihadist sympathetic candidates coming into our system.
Yeah, some are in fact, of course, Muslim, and some, I think, in this case, may not be. But the point is, it is of relevance, and we don't engage in political activity here, but it is of relevance to the vetting of candidates and to an understanding of the policies that they might espouse to know whether they have associations with an outfit that was called Terror High, lest we forget, because it seemed to be incubating quite a number of people who were indeed not just stealth jihadists, but actual violent kinds of jihadists, including, I believe it was a valedictorian of their class who conspired with Al-Qaeda to murder then-President George W. Bush. I mean, this is this is not just anti-Americanism. This is full-on jihad. Diana, let me turn to another topic that I know you're following. This character, Bruce Orr, has been much in the news in the past few months. Remind us who he is, who he's married to, and what we've learned about him, notably through, at the moment, still closed conversations and testimonies that he had yesterday up on Capitol Hill.
Yes, well, Bruce Orr used to be very senior at the Justice Department. He was number 4, people say, until the point at which his associations with Christopher Steele and his wife, Nellie Orr, who worked for Fusion GPS, Christopher Steele also a contractor at Fusion GPS, in a sense a Clinton operative when you break it down with a British accent, however, funneling information we find now confirmed from Christopher Steele, who had been terminated as an FBI informant for lying, funneling that information, continuing to bring it into the FBI, and in it becoming more and more visibly and documented as a focal point of the conspiracy against the 2016 presidential election of Donald Trump.
Now, you're talking about Bruce Orr here as the focal point, as the guy who was engineering moving this mail, this so-called dodgy dossier of Christopher Steele's on which his wife had worked, into the FBI and therefore into the FISA court, among other places, right?
A transmission belt, a hinge. I don't know yet as to his own seniority in the plot. This is a plot. This is a conspiracy. There is no question about it, as, given the documentation we have at this point. But he is a central figure, and it is astonishing that he is still employed by the United States of America, by the people of the United States of America, at the Justice Department, even in his diminished role, which is still quite senior. He heads another desk. This is a story that continues to break. What is not breaking, what I would like to see break, is more about his wife, Nellie Orr, the Russia expert at Fusion GPS, whom Glenn Simpson and Bruce Orr both were reluctant to reveal. In fact, Glenn Simpson did not reveal Nellie Orr's employment as his Russia expert in testifying before two committees on Capitol Hill.
I'm sure he simply overlooked it.
Yes.
A material fact, as they say.
And when you go back to look, her career is in academia, so she has a number of writings available, which I have analyzed for the American Spectator and my website, and find that she is straight up an apologist for Stalin.
Wow. This is a Russian connection that is not trivial, to say the least. And again, what we keep coming back to, Diana West, we've been talking about it in the course of the program, is how could all of this be so studiously ignored, whether it's Hillary Clinton's emails being obtained by the Chinese, or whether it's Dianne Feinstein's involvement with the Chinese, or the manifest involvement of the conspiracy. And I think you're right, this isn't a conspiracy theory. This is now a full-on conspiracy whose elements are still being uncovered. But it really does cry out for an investigation, an appropriate, thorough investigation of what these, well, Democrats have been up to, not simply pursuing the will of the wisp of alleged collusion by Donald Trump. Let me turn in this connection to one of the other prominent Democrats whose name has resurfaced in the past few days, and that is Lanny Davis. Remind us who Lanny Davis is, the role that he has played in the past for the Clinton machine, and Diana West, what he's doing at the moment that has been nothing short of a spectacle, I think.
Yes, well, Lanny Davis is a fixture in the Clinton wheelhouse. He most recently, of course, has been serving as Michael Cohen's lawyer and has been caught even by CNN. And so that's pretty bad. Caught lying, but he's been caught with a story that he can't keep even track of. He's been not only lying, but he's been completely bollocksing his own lies as to what President Trump knew about this absurd meeting, this very sinister and yet also absurd meeting of a group of Russian Americans and one Russian, the lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya, with Don Trump Jr., that took place in the summer of 2016, which is supposed to be the absolute ground zero of the case to impeach Donald Trump and everyone else who supported him. The absurdity is writ large, but the sinister aspect to it, the concoction, the lying, the frame-up, in my view, of this entire event is something of an epic nature and part and parcel of this corruption, of this conspiracy, I would add. I do believe it's related to subvert the election of 2016.
So much more to talk with you about, Diana, but we're out of time for today. Let's do this again next week. Thank you for your time today. Have a great Labor Day weekend, and we'll talk with you on the other side. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.